Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this second day of our conference. Thank you very much for our interesting discussions and the wonderful keynote talks yesterday. Hopefully, we'll keep up pace and have the same quality of the talks and discussions today concerning the discussions on disciplinarity and interdisciplinarity. We have two keynote speakers today, and also parallel sessions like yesterday. And as a final session, we will have, following up on Sheila Jasanoff's keynote talk, roundtable discussion on the topic of science studies. Boundary work in science studies, we'd call it. And in this discussion, we will also try to elaborate on topics that have been raised throughout the conference. So it will tie in with, hopefully, with some of the major issues of our other keynote speakers as well. As usual, with the second day of conferences, people are arriving, and we will begin in just a few minutes with the first keynote speaker. First, I'd just like to mention that after our keynote and the first session of parallel sessions, we will have lunch, and at the same time there will be a show put on right outside here, a work. It's a part of the Modern Music Festival in Oslo this week. It's a work by John Cage based on chess playing, and it's a remake of a famous incident in the 60s, I think, where John Cage played Marcel Duchamp, and there's the moving of the pawns will translate into music. So that's going to be on when we leave the auditorium, and so I ask you to be sort of quiet when you leave for lunch. We will be in this room most of the time. One of the parallel sessions will be taking place upstairs as like yesterday, and lunch will be in the same place as yesterday. Next speaker, our first keynote speaker for today, is a man with many functions and engagement in Scandinavian social sciences, and more specifically, educational sciences. Like Rudolf Stichfeld, he works to a large extent within the paradigm of systems theory and writes on a wide range of topics, including education, knowledge, electronic media, and general systems theory. He's written too many books to mention in Danish, and I'd just like to mention some of his titles in English. There are The Hyper-Complex Society from 2003 and Knowledge Education and Learning, E-Learning in the Knowledge Society from 2006. Lars Bortrup has strong ties with Norway, having taught and acted in many capacities here. At home in Denmark, he has until quite recently been the dean at the Danish University of Education, an institution which has since merged with Aarhus University in Denmark. Lars Bortrup is currently a professor at the Department of Education and Philosophy at Aalborg University in Denmark. And the title of his talk today is University Mergers Between Humboldt and Stanford, Construction and Deconstruction Disciplines and Interdisciplinarities. Lars Bortrup, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the invitation, thank you for the presentation, and thank you, I think, on behalf of everybody here for the very nice and full dinner last night, which was perhaps part of the reason for starting a bit late today. That was, and also, you know, we experienced, you know, a different Oslo than I'm used to. You know, I'm used to the sort of the Norwegian Oslo, along the main road, you know, looking at the Royal Palace, and suddenly we were in sort of a different environment, different sort of social system, perhaps even, and going through that and then entering the proper restaurant, and that was sort of interesting for me, you know, I've been so many times in Oslo, but never invited to that place. So thank you for that. I have rather a large number of slides, but I'll manage. I would say that if you look at the conference questions, you put up three questions. Is academia becoming interdisciplinary? Is disciplinarity perhaps even an inherent operative mode of modern academia? And I think we got a very convincing answer to that yesterday. But then there's the third question: if so, how and to what extent should our institutions provide for interdisciplinarity? That's the third question you're sort of raising, and I'll focus on that one because as my I some years ago I was the rector of the Danish Library School, then I became the dean, as you said, for the Danish School of Education, which was actually a faculty under Aarhus University. So I would like sort of to base my presentation on the experience I've had, the reflection of the experiences. Are they, and I will not answer this question, I think, mainly in a normative way, but rather in a descriptive and critical way, because my question is, how and to what extent do our institutions provide for interdisciplinarity and disciplinarity as well? Do they? Don't they? And my critical answer is that if you look at the management part of the university, they are very often not supporting disciplinarity and interdisciplinarity, but actually challenging it. So that's my approach. So I try to sort of perform a kind of participatory science in action study. And doing this, I'm inspired by Latour, his science in action approach from the 1980s, but of course my approach is not going into the natural science laboratories, but into the management meeting halls, etc., to see what is actually happening there, what are the social processes in that field. So I study not science, but science management in action. And I also agree that there's no great divide between minds, but only shorter and longer networks. Harder facts are not the rule, but the exception, since they are needed only in a very few cases to displace others in a large scale out of their usual ways. And that's really also, you know, if you translate that into management language at the university I'm referring to, Aarhus University, because that's my case, I see that very much as the point that harder facts are not the rule but the exception. Arguments are used if they fit into the power play of the management group. So that's sort of my empirical background, and it's the case of Aarhus University, but of course generalized and it's put into perspective, and just to present you with the case, Aarhus University is the second largest university in Denmark, almost as big as they say as Copenhagen. Not as old. It was established in 1935. In 19, 1954, all the faculties were established. It started with the humanities and health in 1935, then followed theology in 1942. Theology was part of the humanities, but theology became so strong because of very strong professors and very strong research bases that it sort of gained its independence as a separate faculty, which was strange actually and a point in itself, because it was strong because it subscribed to French existentialism and to German phenomenology like Husserl and Heidegger, and therefore actually it sort of belonged to or it was closely related to philosophy, but on the list it was separated, and a distinct faculty was established in 1942. Then came the natural sciences in 1954. But the whole process was actually sort of a bricolage process of things happening and possibilities used. Then in 2007, an explosion happened. It was a forced explosion coming from the outside, that there were mergers of Danish universities, and suddenly the graphical representation of Aarhus University looked like this. The dark blue parts of the flower are the old faculties: theology, humanities, social sciences, science and health sciences, as it's called. But then came all the new schools from the outside, like the engineering science, agricultural sciences, educational research, that's the Danish School of Education, commercial research and environmental research, and agricultural research actually also. And this lasted only for 4 years, and then a third transformation happened, and the newcomers were sort of merged into the old faculties, and my school of education was disappeared, my job disappeared, therefore I sort of went to Aalborg, and therefore perhaps I'm a bit critical about the process. But you see, the result was now a huge faculty of arts combining humanities, theology, education, for some reason, science and technology, combining the old natural science faculty with the engineering and agricultural science and environmental research, and health remained as health, or healthy as health, and then business and social sciences combining commercial research with the old social science department. And if there was an argument, it was the argument that that if you combine two things, you will get the best from both things. You will get relevance plus basic deep science in a fantastic combination. The argument was here, looking back in history, that here we had the beauty of the Humboldt University with the traditional faculties of theology, law, medicine, philosophy, and then natural science came a bit later. Then what was sort of the argument was the beauty of Stanford University, and Stanford University not as an empirical fact, but as an argument that actually when Oxford University presented itself to the environment, our rector, our vice chancellor, said that Aarhus University is the Stanford University of Europe, no less. And you know, you have this superficial sort of structural not identity, but you know, you have the schools, the business, earth sciences, education, engineering, humanities and sciences, law, medicine. So it sort of resembled of the structure of Stanford. But then suddenly Stanford disappeared, and here we had, and we still have, a sort of strange combinational situation of a Humboldt-oriented structure of the university with the faculties, but still with the intentionality of being relevance-oriented and oriented to the wider world, to the businesses, to the government, etc. So that's the very short story, and then I'll come back to it. One of the backgrounds is the classical dispute disciplines of the modern university, and very much the question of orienting the university towards the environment, being relevant to society, or orienting the university into the disciplines, to the creation of knowledge for the sake of knowledge. And sort of the discussion, the classical discussion was repeated. The Humboldt University or the Friedrich Wilhelms Universität zu Berlin, and referring to the classical Der Streit der Fakultäten of Immanuel Kant, which is actually, I think, an interesting text because it has sort of two different positions. First, it presents what are called the higher faculties, theology, law, and medicine, which are faculties for the higher authority of society. And then you have the low faculty, which is philosophy. So you have the four classical faculties of theology, law, medicine, and philosophy. And Kant actually says that the university is organized in accordance with two principles, I think. Relevance, usefulness for the government, and truths, the truths of or coming from human reason. Relevance for the government is represented by theology, the eternal good of human beings, law, the social good, and medicine, the bodily good, or the health of human beings. But then you have the truths from human reason represented by the faculty of philosophy. And as he says later on in the text, and I don't know, Professor Slichty, correct me on that point. Perhaps he only thought that higher authorities read the first three or four pages of his text. But then comes everything depends on truths, while the usefulness promised by the upper faculties to the government is only of secondary importance. So you have this inner contradiction of arguments, I think, in this text. Then this is followed up by, for example, Schleiermacher, in 1808, the philosophical faculty is the real university and the master of the others, he said. And Humboldt in 1810, if the university should realize, as he says, the pure idea of science, then loneliness and freedom will be the dominating principles in the circle. So that was the one ideal, and that was the ideal up to 2006 and 7, and then suddenly a second model, ideal model, was presented, the model of Stanford. And again, going back to the grounding fathers, the donator Leland Stanford, who was both a governor and a very successful businessman, brought a lot of money to open Stanford University in 1891. And here the basic principles which were presented were that it is co-educational. Both sexes are allowed into Stanford University from the very beginning. It's non-denominational, and it's practical, and that is perhaps the most important argument. It's producing cultured and useful citizens. And therefore, it was organized in 1906 with faculties for the world, you know, the professional schools of medicine, business, engineering, education and law. And well, yeah, here you have the same, you know, Leland Stanford and his wife in 1891, in the opening speech, said that the university should promote the public welfare by exercising an influence on behalf of humanity and civilization. And this is still, you know, repeated in the opening speech of 2011. More than a century later, it remains dedicated to finding solutions to the great challenges of the day and to preparing our students for leadership into today's complex world, or hyper-complex world, who knows. But that's, those were the two sort of main arguments presented by the government of Aarhus University in this change of structures. You could even also relate this to what you could call the genealogy of university models, the Humboldt model, referring, I think, to a liberal democracy ideal, while the Stanford model is referring, I think, much more to a republicanistic democracy model, you know, that the basic concept is civic virtue, Bürgersinn in German, that it's the moral position that makes the individual human being to take consideration for the common good, and it, in matters of dispute, to value common good higher than personal interests. So accountability in the philosophical sense is then a very basic concept in this model. Okay, so what I have presented in the first part is a distinction between two basic criteria for the governance of a university, but also for creating disciplines and developing disciplines. Is it a knowledge-oriented criterion which is used, or is it a relevance-oriented criterion? And if you look at Luhmann, I wouldn't call it, it shouldn't be criteria, it would rather be attractors for the construction of disciplines, or the backgrounds for the construction and emergence of disciplines. He says that in Wissenschaft der Gesellschaft, that some disciplines emerge according to science internal distinctions, primarily physics, chemistry, biology, psychology and sociology. That was you know, the mechanisms that you displayed yesterday so beautifully. And then he says, often disciplines emerge, or other disciplines emerge, in close relation to the reflection theories of social function systems. Profession-related disciplines are theology, law, medicine, and since the 17th or the 18th century, also pedagogy or education science. So we have two different sort of routes for the emergence of disciplines, internal processes and external processes that reflection theories or reflection functions of social subsystems sort of develop into university professions or sort of university disciplines. So you have two different criteria, and these were the criteria which were sort of the center of the struggle, the fight, the arguments at Aarhus University: the internal knowledge criteria and the external relevance criteria. Then, if you go back to the case of Aarhus University with this perspective, then I would like to display what I would call the contingent construction of disciplines at this university, and of course with the assumption that this is not extraordinary, but that you can find similar processes at very many universities. So if you go back, just to recall the situation, this was the process, this was the history. We have the model of 2011 with the four faculties. Then, what were the arguments for actually leaving a very strong Stanfordian position in 2007, which was really presented very aggressively in the public discussion and also internally. And as you could see, presented as this beautiful flower of faculties. So what was the process going from that position in 2007 and then totally reorganizing the fragile structures of faculties and disciplines? You have two main arguments, and you know, sort of external arguments, which are based on cost-benefit and knowledge economy ideas. But of course, universities, you know, when we invest so much in universities, they should pay back. I'm not using this argument as in the idea that that arguments from the environment directly influence the formation of disciplines. But what I do is I look at the arguments and the way they are translated by the university government and thus transformed into internal arguments. So they take what they can use from the national government, from business interest, etc., and translate those arguments into the internal disputes of or strikes their faculty. Then you have internal arguments based very much on general management ideas and rooted in power structures in the management board of the university. And actually, what is, I don't know if it's a surprise, at least perhaps it's a pity, but you have find no arguments concerning principles for the proper organization of disciplines. So if you look at back at the sort of German discussion in the beginning of the 19th century, you find nothing similar to that in the discussion at Aarhus University or at universities in Denmark. Rather, you the proper organization of disciplines is not really a case, or it doesn't seem to be really relevant for the government, for the rectorate, for the vice chancellor, and the group of deans. If you look at first at the external arguments and the way they are translated into discussions at the and fights and streiten internally at the university, it's very much the spelling out of the idea of the so-called competition state, that the modern European welfare state is transforming into a competition state, a state of which the most important duty and job is to maintain competitive as a nation compared to new Asian economies, etc. And therefore, we search an education or means for the competitiveness of the state. There's much reference to announcements like the State of the Union speech of Obama, you know, like this, that, as he said in 2011, nations like China and India realized that with some changes of their own, they could compete in this new world. They started educating the children earlier and longer, etc. And this is our generation's Sputnik moment. Now we have to fight back and to orient our research and our education towards these competitive goals. And the same, you find exactly the same arguments, not surprisingly, by Arne Duncan, the foreign in Foreign Affairs, actually, in 2010, that globalization means that U.S. students will have to compete throughout their careers with their peers in Canada, China, India, European countries, and other rapidly developing states. I don't know if European countries belong to this group of rapidly developing states, but nevertheless. As President Obama has warned, the nation that out-educates us today is going to out-compete us tomorrow. So that's the sort of phrases used internally also at the university. And actually, one of the translation mechanisms was that these arguments were then translated into an academic book. It's only in Danish, but perhaps you can understand the title, Konkurrencestaten, the competition state. A very well-received book by a professor at the Copenhagen School of Business, Ove K. Pedersen, who sort of takes this trend and transforms it into a proper academic argument with footnotes and all the stuff. And this is used very much. You can see there's evidence. This is based on the proper studies from the social science department at the Copenhagen Business School. This is actually the fact. Then, also, of course, the growth in research expenditure. Here you have the Danish figures up to 2006, I think, where you can see that the growth in research expenditure is very, very slow in private research organizations and private, business-oriented research, but is really growing at the universities and growing, of course, even more during the latest years. And this leads, this is translated into a number of demands from the national government, and again, demands taken by the rectorate and translated and transformed into the university debate about the structure of faculties, that they must change into mass universities, that they must change the success criterion from excellence and relevance, that they shouldn't be single target organizations with excellent research, but they should become multi-target organizations with research, development, education, advisory services, knowledge dissemination, and that they should also, from working within internally defined well-established disciplines, the production of knowledge must be defined by reference to societal problems, sectors, and professions. So please change the disciplines so that they can be, well, I don't know if that's the proper term, but structurally coupled with the sectors and professions in society. And you should become organizational, open, and hetero-referential as a university. Well, that's not the words used by the government, but that's what they mean. And again, these are the main arguments in the Streiterfakultäten at the university. As a consequence, we had a very dramatic change of University Management Act in 2003 in Denmark, with a hierarchical management structure. So every level is, there's no election anymore, democratic election among peers, but the rector, the vice chancellor, gets his job from the external board, and then he selects. Deans, and deans select department heads of department, etc. So it's a linear hierarchical management structure. The new public management model is really realized in full speed, with contracts and control and incentives. Boards should have an external majority. And then you have these forced mergers in 2006 and 2007 with the Danish Institute of Environmental Studies, the Aarhus School of Business, the Danish Institute of Agriculture, and the Danish University of Education were merged into Aarhus University in sort of an open competition phase, where they were floating on the market, and then they were picked up by the strong universities. So that's, I think, a different process than the sort of, if you read in the textbooks at least, ideal process of what happened at in Germany in the beginning of the 19th century. Internal arguments were very much sort of business-oriented. Well, the first phase was the beauty of Humboldt. The second phase was the appropriateness of the Stanford flower, as they said. But then the third phase, from 2007 to 2011, the main arguments were to break down barriers. As they say, every organizational unit has its own limitations, and this is the quote from the official text of the rectorate. By establishing one unified Aarhus University, we are reducing internal barriers by greatly cutting down on the number of organizational units. So cut down organizational units and you will get a unified, strong university. One unified senior management group. Every leader, as they say, and again, this is a quote from the text, focuses on his or her own particular area of responsibility. We will ensure a shared focus on academic excellence by creating a unified senior management group with responsibility for the entire university. From now on, this group will consist of the rector, the pro-rector, the university director, and the four deans. So the deans are moved from their faculties into this central management group. Then, administrative coherence, external market incentives, but also internal market incentives, that they actually create an internal market where faculties and foremost disciplines compete for getting funding. So you don't have basic funding, or you have reduced basic fundings, but you have to compete internally with the other disciplines at the university. The result is very, you know, put in a very general way, that there, you know, what is emerging is a university in the university. A university functioning according to the principles you displayed yesterday, sort of functioning in despite of the external formal university. So you, there's an emergence of an informal university with informal dynamic knowledge system based processes within the formal university organization. And if you look at the literature, if you look at the public debate, this is very much also the case, the public case, you know, this is actually presented as the case by professors, etc., at the university. So this doubling of the university is one of the consequences of this process. So then I will turn to the second last point that I will make. What does this mean for the emergence of interdisciplinary structures? I'll look at the dynamism of disciplines leading into interdisciplinarities, which are sometimes then developing into new disciplines, and look at it between the discipline orientation and the problem orientation. Again, if you go back to Luhmann and the Wissenschaft der Gesellschaft, he says that you have three types of interdisciplinary structures, as he called them, occasional interdisciplinarity, and he always used examples from his own production. Loan of terminology, autopoiesis, for example, is what he calls an occasional interdisciplinarity example of that. Then you have temporary interdisciplinarity, And here he says temporary interdisciplinarity is interdisciplinarity based on problem orientation. You know, we have a common problem. You can contribute with this. You can contribute with that. So the problem is sort of creating the framework for interdisciplinarity. And then his third model is the model of transdisciplinarity, the establishment of new paradigms like cybernetics, for example, in which different disciplines can gather. So you can look at the internal dynamics of the system of novelty-oriented disciplines, as you displayed yesterday, but they are then fueled, it seems, by problem-based incentives. And therefore, I think there's a very fragile and interesting balance between a self-referring principle discipline system and a problem-oriented environment. And they are sort of they are influencing both of these factors are influencing the process. Yesterday we looked at the internal, you may call them incentives, of interdisciplinarity, the search for novelty, as you displayed. But what are the external incentives for interdisciplinarity? Still, you know, going back to the question, the third question of the conference, that what can we do in the management structure of the universities to support interdisciplinarity? And I see at least two, but of course there are other models of incentives. One is that disciplines are structurally coupled through institutional means. And one example from Aarhus University was the announcement that bringing medicine and anthropology together, as they did in a center, will solve the mystery of cancer. Very optimistic, totally nonsense, actually. But that was actually one of these. You know, when you create this internal market, I should say that this internal market functions well. I have it here also. The internal market for interdisciplinary activities. That they reduced the basic funding of faculties, research funding, by 10%, and took these 10% into a volume, into basic funding of this internal market. And this internal market is functioning, you know, similar to a beauty contest, because decisions, you know, you have to announce ideas for interdisciplinary activities, and the decisions are made by a committee appointed by the vice chancellor. So you have to please him in order to get money for your new activities. And there, medicine and anthropology was one of these successful mergers of disciplines into a unit like this. And as I said yesterday, this very often, perhaps as a rule, leads into superficial and amateuristic interdisciplinary constructions. Then also you have a second sort of framework, that disciplines are structurally coupled through common problem orientation. And I think some of the schools, like the School of Education, the School of Business, are examples of this, that they provide a framework for different disciplines to work together because they have a common problem, for example, the problem of the proper education in society, etc. And I'll try to provide you with an example of how this can function from the School of Education, because, you know, I was the dean of the School of Education. And if you see, look at the history of the Danish School of Education, it started more than 150 years ago. Not as a university, of course, but as a high school for teachers, teachers high school it was called. And there, during this these years, emerged a number of small departments, the Department of Natural Science Pedagogy, for example, the Department of Reading and Writing Pedagogy, the Department of this and that, and always functioning as curriculum reflection departments for the Danish educational system, for the primary and lower secondary school system. Then in the year 2000, this was changed, and the high school, the teachers' high school was changed into an independent university, the Danish Pedagogical University, or the Danish University of Education, with four departments: the Departments of Pedagogical Psychology, the Department of Pedagogical Anthropology, the Department of Pedagogical Sociology, and the Department of Pedagogical Philosophy. And then finally, in 2007, when I became the dean, it was again changed into three departments: Departments of Learning, Department of Teaching, and Department of Education. And if you look at that and that process compared to the Lumanian analysis, I think this is totally in line with Luhmann's analysis, that you start, as he said, you have two roots for disciplines. You have the internal roots of knowledge, but you also have the external roots of functional systems in society reflecting on themselves. And here you have, in the first long phase, curriculum reflection as subsystems of the educational system, but having a semi-separate identity as departments in this high school for teachers. Then you have a liberation from this curriculum reflection function through, as Luhmann called them, temporary interdisciplinary constructions. And these are really temporary interdisciplinary constructions, because pedagogical psychology, combining pedagogy with psychology, anthropology, sociology, philosophy, is actually, to merge two disciplines to create something temporarily working as a liberation from the former situation. And then they were again transformed from interdisciplinary constructions into independent disciplines, and actually the disciplines of learning, of teaching, and of education are recognized as stable disciplines within the field of education theory or pedagogy. Then my final point is then just more like an open question. This was the process, this was the very, summer. I think a semi-cynical presentation of what is actually happening if we don't accept that we have this open academic debate of the best of all worlds. And if there are two different aspects, sort of, on the one hand, the discipline orientation, on the other hand, the problem orientation, then I think we also stay in a situation with a very fragile and dynamic balance of these two orientations. Because as we saw, a superficial problem orientation with forced interdisciplinary constructions can lead to the most awful things. On the other hand, if you are only sort of isolated in an internal orientation of the discipline to itself and to other disciplines as internal environments of the discipline, then also you may create a problem. And you see, the two different models, for example, displayed as the reproduction of disciplinarity and interdisciplinarity among students. Here you have the display of the so-called subject-based learning principle with the beautiful old lecture hall from Bologna from the 14th century, with actually the professor reading from his textbook, controlled by colleagues, and then attended by nice students. Some of them are asleep, others are actually talking to each other, etc. So this is the lecture hall of today's university, I think. Perhaps in a greater format, because now we have a mass university. But then, on the other hand, you also find universities going into the totally different direction. For example, focusing totally on problem-based learning. This example is an example from a very new university in Finland, the Aalto University, which is actually a very prestigious university, which has got a lot of funding created by the merger of, I think, three different universities, and funded heavily. It's really a prestigious project in Finland. And there, they base themselves totally on the idea of problem-based learning. So disciplines are hidden behind the problem, interdisciplinarity, or even, finish my presentation with a provocation, non-disciplinarity as the principle is the basic educational principle. Here you see this place from their lecture hall, which is not a lecture hall, but which is sort of a working environment. If they want to gather in a group together with a professor, they have these college chairs. But that is not very much used, because they sit in their small boxes or in laboratories creating solutions to today's and tomorrow's problems, as they say. If you ask them about the educational and pedagogical principles behind this, they say it like this. Perhaps it's difficult to see, but as you can see, quality of teaching and curriculum is combined of different elements. The important fact is that they have this phrase, which is, has no sort of proper academic background or research background, but this is the sort of the official position, that teaching should have or create expertise value, which is hard elements multiplied by soft elements, and not only, what do we call it, soft elements So soft elements are of course important. So they should learn a little bit about core competences in business, technology, art and design. But then the soft elements are important: teamwork and communication, language and cultural activities, project working, managerial leadership, curiosity and hunger for learning, and passion and love. So that's sort of the format of the pedagogical. And there you have really the outmost sort of situation of, I think, non-disciplinarity. So of course, here you have the balance, and many European universities are trying to find the balance between those two orientations. So my last question is more like, it's not a real question, but that is rather, the question of, when is a university not a university? And how do we actually... how do we know that? I like the introduction, the first sentence in Luhmann's Religion der Gesellschaft, where he says something, translated into English: how do we know when we see something that what we see is religion? And, you know, similarly, how do we know when we see something that what we see is actually a university? So, thank you.